This week, the bold Eamon Torsley is stepping back into the Let Me Explain studio and is having a look at one of the most pivotal and important news stories of the 1990s. Here's Eamon.
If you're like me and grew up in the 1970s and 80s, you'll know that barely a day passed without news reports of violence in Northern Ireland. It was the backdrop to most of our lives. Like many people who travelled north of the border, I remember the extensive checkpoints and security barriers that ringed Belfast and the body and bag searches when you went into shops. In the early years of the 90s, there appeared to be no end in sight to the troubles, with the violence continuing unabated as one potential solution after another failed. So how did we go from intractable conflict at the beginning of the 1990s to an IRA ceasefire in 1994? Let me explain.
Let Me Explain with Sean Defoe, a News Talk original.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Explain. It's Eamon Torsley here filling in for Sean Defoe. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Well, the 1990s started as the previous decade ended in the north, with attacks across Northern Ireland and an intensification of IRA attacks in Britain. The news reports we all listened to had a familiar feel day in, day out.
A bomb either in or under the policeman's car exploded as he was driving out of the town. The blast started a fire which was so intense no one was able to approach the vehicle. The bomb shattered windows in nearby shops and houses. 18 people were injured, including a one-year-old boy and an 87-year-old woman. All this after the IRA was thought to be ending attacks which could cause civilian casualties.
The gunman then got out and he was told that there was a bomb in the van which he was to drive to the checkpoint. He was also told it would go off in 5 minutes. The man drove the van into the checkpoint and shouted a warning. A short time later, there was a small explosion. This may have been the detonator going off.
It used to be a busy town centre, for years unscathed by IRA bombs. Today it's devastated, shops destroyed, people without jobs. Police were evacuating the town as the £1,000 bomb packed inside a van exploded early this morning.
In a statement after the attack, the IRA said it was warning people to stay away from military installations and vehicles in Britain.
As a student of Irish politics in UCD and later Queen's in Belfast, I watched events unfold with little sign there was any breakthrough to end the decades-old conflict. I heard the same refrain from politicians throughout Ireland and Britain. There would be no discussion with terrorists until the violence ended. There were numerous failed attempts to get local government up and running in the north to try and alienate the men of violence. Then all was to change in 1993 when it was revealed the leader of the Irish Nationalist SDLP party, John Hume, had been meeting with the Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams for a number of years. Sinn Féin was considered to be the political wing of the IRA by those in authority. In fact, for most of my life, I wasn't allowed to hear members of that party speak due to censorship laws south of the border. John Hume was trying to break the deadlock in the north after so many other failed initiatives. What was remarkable about the revelation, the talks had been ongoing since 1988 in secrecy and took both the public, politicians and seasoned journalists by surprise. We also learned in 1993 secret talks had been taking place between the British government and the IRA, even though politicians publicly insisted that could never happen while the IRA campaign continued. Suddenly we all learned that talks had been taking place for some time to end the violence, while we were all kept in the dark. Well, journalist Eamon Malley, author of Eyewitness to War and Peace, outlines how secret contacts in the late 80s involving a Belfast-based priest and attempts to contact southern politicians laid the foundation for the ceasefire that would take a number of years to come to fruition.
Hume was talking to Adams, and that was very significant. And the background to that was Alec Reid had gone to talk to Charles Haughey at his North Dublin home and to try and persuade him to meet with Adams. Haughey was terrified of that. Particularly against his background, he told me himself of the arms trial and all that type of thing. But he said, if you can persuade Hume to engage with Adams, then he'd be my proxy.
While the talks were ongoing in secrecy, there was also a growing realisation by all the parties to the conflict that a stalemate of sorts had been reached.
This IRA spokesperson said to me, in terms of a guerrilla force like the IRA and a superior force such as the British government, there are two imperatives. The imperative for the superior force, the British government, always was to crush the guerrilla force, the IRA. But the imperative for the guerrilla force, the IRA, was to keep hitting and hurting the establishment in the wings, every opportunity that arose. And as we now know, the IRA motor bombed Downing Street. It attacked the airport, Heathrow Airport in London, and so it kept going. But there comes a point where both sides, there came a point where both sides realized that it was time to sue for peace.
One aspect of the secret talks that may come as a surprise to many younger listeners was that much of the media coverage south of the border was hostile to the Hume-Adams initiative. Newspaper article after article slammed the talks. It was hard to understand how anyone could be so critical of attempts to end the violence. And it was one of the reasons I decided to continue my studies in Belfast to get a different perspective of the situation rather than rely on the reports I was reading. So at the outset of 1993, there was little indication of what was to come. Loyalist and Republican violence continued, but now the secret talks were public knowledge, the British and Irish governments worked on finding a formula of words that would encourage the IRA to end its campaign of violence for good. The effort was led by two leaders who knew each other well from their time as ministers in their own governments, British Prime Minister John Major and Taoiseach Albert Reynolds. While in recent years the focus has been on Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern, Major and Reynolds' efforts were key in driving the peace process. Their efforts to end the conflict faced a huge challenge, though, after the Shankill bombing by the IRA in October 1993, followed weeks later by the UFF attack on Greysteel in County Derry. The deaths of civilians in both atrocities horrified the public at home and abroad. It was really hard at that time to hear talk of peace while such attacks continued. However, Albert Reynolds and John Major persisted and finally agreed a Downing Street declaration they hoped would provide the much-needed clarification on a range of issues about Britain's attitude to Northern Ireland, as well as Irish government commitments aimed at reassuring the unionist population in the north.
It opens the door to those who abandon violence, to those who for decades have shut themselves out. If the provisionals will end and renounce violence for good, the British government is prepared to enter into preliminary exploratory dialogue with Sinn Féin within 3 months, when cessation of violence has been clearly established. And the joint declaration reinforces very strongly the three-stranded political talks which have made significant progress over the last 2 years, a process that involves both of our governments and all of the constitutional parties.
We believe it offers a framework for lasting peace, achieved on terms which in no way infringe the fundamental principles to which we are both committed. It is a fully balanced document which safeguards the rights and basic concerns of both traditions. We cannot have winners and losers if we want lasting peace. It is fair to all and threatens nobody. Rather, it represents an opportunity for everybody to accept that our differences can be fully and satisfactorily addressed and solved through the political process, and that violence should have no place, since it only deepens the differences between two communities. We hope this historic opportunity for peace will be taken.
However, there was to be a long wait and some periods of drama before the IRA were to indicate they had received the assurances they needed to end their campaign. Governments making it clear Sinn Féin would not be admitted to talks until that happened. The violence continued relentlessly. The declaration was made on December 15, 1993. January 1994 saw a crucial intervention as key figures from US politics exerted their influence to try to secure a ceasefire. Prominent US senators, including Edward Kennedy and Daniel Moynihan, urged the American President Bill Clinton to grant Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams a visa to visit the States. That was in an effort to persuade the wider Republican movement to back efforts to bring violence to an end. It was a pivotal moment. The UK government lobbied hard to prevent a visa being granted, while Irish-American interests stressed its importance in demonstrating that politics could pay dividends compared to the so-called armed struggle. That month, Bill Clinton made one of the most important decisions in the wake of the Downing Street Declaration and granted the visa. It wasn't until spring 1994, though, when the IRA held a three-day ceasefire, that we started to learn just how realistic the prospect of a longer ceasefire was. So the following months saw speeches by political leaders trying to clarify what would happen if there was a ceasefire, both in terms of politics and militarily. The public waited for any indication that progress was being made. July and early August 1994 saw increased speculation. A decision on a ceasefire was close. A special Sinn Féin Ordesh was held in July, with party leader Gerry Adams saying that the Downing Street Declaration didn't adequately deal with some of the core issues. However, days later, though, he confirmed he met the leadership of the IRA and was guardedly optimistic about the prospects for peace. Finally, on August 31st, came the announcement people across Ireland had waited and hoped for, with journalists told the IRA's decision.
The 300-word statement says that recognising the potential of the current situation and in order to enhance the democratic peace process, they have decided that as of midnight tonight, there will be a complete cessation of military operations and that all IRA units have been instructed accordingly. The statement goes on to talk about the historic crossroads which has now been reached and salutes the various members of the Republican movement who've been involved in the struggle for the past 25 years.
Well, that prompted celebratory scenes on the Falls Road in West Belfast. And Gerry Adams, the Sinn Féin leader, addressed those cheering crowds.
This is a generation of men and women who have fought the British for the last 25 years and who are undefeated by the British. They have created, if you like, a crucial moment, a decisive moment in the history of this island and of Anglo-Irish relationships. This struggle is not over.
Of course, we now know how fragile the peace process was, as the ceasefire only lasted 18 months. In the course of my studies, I asked Republicans about opposition to the ceasefire in the IRA, and I was left in no doubt that there were those opposed to ending the campaign of violence and who wanted to see what they called the armed struggle continue. Eamon Malley says we learned later of the level of opposition.
The split came inside the IRA. By the time post-ceasefire, as many as 85% of Republicans had gone home. They didn't become active. They didn't join the dissidents or anything.
The IRA ceasefire of 1994 seems like a footnote in history now, overshadowed by the efforts to secure the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. But we shouldn't underestimate how important it was in our history. For the first time in decades, people in Northern Ireland got to experience what life was like without the threat of violence for a sustained period, and that laid the foundation for future progress on ending the conflict. I'm Eamon Torsney, filling in for Sean Defoe. John Keogh is the series editor, and don't forget to subscribe.